Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. We have part two of our series with Mike Holt, Managing Director of Chip Ganassi Racing. In part one, which I thoroughly enjoyed, we really focused on Mike's entree to the sport, his early days coming up, where he worked, who he learned from, and delved into his time with Chip Ganassi a little bit, this starting in the early 1990s. He's been there ever since, someone with one of the longest tenures with any racing team in North American racing. But we really made an effort to limit part one to Mike and focus part two on Mike and his time with Chip. And so that's where we are here. We met up at Sonoma, the test ahead of the 2016 season finale, and really enjoyed, we launched with one of the weirdest phases of Ganassi's IndyCar program, where they transitioned from the famed combination of Jimmy Vassar and Juan Montoya to the very unexpected Nick Manassian and Bruno Junqueira experience. Got into his management style. Very different cat, and I mean that in the best way. So spoke a little bit about how he does things. Obviously, he's been doing it for Chip for decades, which means something works there. He's worked with Scott Dixon now for 15 years, been on his timing stand, has the closest possible relationship with Dixie, and that's something that we got into, something that fascinates me. Spoke about Dixie's amazing fuel-saving capabilities and how that was developed, yet another, I don't know if it's a mystery anymore, but it still just was really interesting to hear that tale told again in podcast form. Spoke about how he handles, as the managing director, when a team like his is off just a little bit. Something's missing, not at that championship level that they expect to be. Spoke a bit about the pass, this year being the 20th anniversary of Alex Zanardi's insane pass at Laguna Seca, passing Brian Herta, another Ganassi driver, in 1996 for the win there. Spoke about Zanardi's, one of his great pre-race driving routines to get ready for making insane things like the pass. And then we closed on his thoughts and emotions on bidding farewell to Target after 27 years. So part two is more on his life and times with Chip's IndyCar program. And I'm sure we will do a number three and a number four on more good stuff.
So, Mr. Hull, we're back. We're sitting here in our lovely home state of California. Here, actually, Sonoma Raceway at the end of a lovely test day here, about 10 days before the season finale, looking out on the valley, beautiful sun going down a little bit. We finished our part one really before we got into, I'd say, kind of the 2000s. Mm. You wrapped up with a great story about Mr. Juan Monterior and his insistence that his way around Homestead was going to work, which it was. But what we were waiting to get into was really the, I guess you could say, the modern era of Chip Ganassi racing. And we were just talking a couple moments ago about a bit of a transition point where you had Vassar, Montoya, before that Herta, into a little bit of a, I don't know if you want to say an awkward phase, but there are a couple of drivers that came along who by name didn't sound like the natural successors, and Nick Manassian and Bruno Junqueira. They didn't last too long. What did that transition point do for you? What did it tell you? Were there any big lessons on the philosophy of how you guys go racing, and whether you strayed from that, or was there not that much to it?
No, I think there was actually quite a bit to it. Chip, I think, really wanted to provide a platform for very talented, young, very talented drivers. Nicholas Manassian and Bruno Junqueira had come from Formula 3000.
Yeah.
And they fought it out with each other for the championship, I think, the previous year. And I think Bruno did win the championship that year, I think. I don't know. Yeah. My mind's not that great. So we tested them and signed them, and away we went. Bruno was this fearless guy that had enormous natural ability and had the uncanny nature to understand ovals in particular really early in his career with us with frictionless driving. He understood that concept extremely well, whereas Nicholas was a terrific road track racer but had a tough time with the ovals. And
when you say frictionless, you're talking about efficiency of every movement.
Yes.
To turn that into speed.
Yeah, you know, just the smallest turn of the wheel, you don't want.
Yeah.
You want almost, you want the car to turn itself and the driver to sit back and watch it happen. That's not quite the way it works, but that's almost what you want. And
that's what you'd get from some of the veteran, you know, the veteran oval drivers who teach younger ones, and they'd, you know, make motions of turning the steering wheel, saying, every time you do that, you go slower. So just think about that.
Yeah, you know, and maybe it's kind of like, you know, somebody that is at home and they go to the lake or they have a pond in their backyard and they toss a rock across the water, you know, and see how many times it skips. It find, you know, four or five times and it sinks. And driving on an oval might be similar in the sense that every time you turn that wheel, the car slows down. So it's just the slightest thing. The fastest people we've ever had that have driven on ovals have actually wanted to turn to the right at the exit of the corner. So that's a pretty neutral car, but that's the fast way around an oval. It's just a matter of how long you can keep that drive style going for you without scraping the wall.
Yeah.
So that takes a lot of effort, and we've had really, really good drivers that would never do that also.
Mm.
It takes all kinds to make it happen, but in relationship to the question about Nicholas and Bruno, both extremely talented race drivers, and both during and then after they left us did some pretty good things in different kinds of formula. Manassian has done a great job in the WEC series for years as a factory driver.
Yeah.
He proved his worth. There's no question about that. It's just his worth for us just wasn't right.
So from there, it was a bit of an interesting period as well, because they didn't last as long as they had hoped, and I'm sure as you had hoped as well. We had some fun names, Mamo Gidleys of the world, and a few others that came in trying to be solutions for you in IndyCar. Move forward a couple years, and Chip Ganassi Racing also adds its first sports car racing team. And sometimes people forget that Chip, although he did have a very solid IndyCar career, also had a bit of a sports car career too. So wasn't totally foreign to Chip when the team moved into Grand Am. What were those early-ish, almost mid-2000s like for you and the team, knowing that you are in just about every series in North America, whether it's stock car racing, whether it's sports car, IndyCar? As a managing director, I'm guessing you, those are not days where a lot of sleep was involved in your life?
Well, I guess not, but I don't know that there ever has been.
Mm.
You know, if you concentrate wholly on your job in motorsports, sleep becomes a bit overrated. And you concentrate really, really hard on the reality of what you have to do next. When we started in the Grand Am series in 2004, it was eyes wide open for sure. We at the time were a Toyota team, and Toyota was willing to actually, the engine side of it is really kind of interesting. They really didn't have an engine that was technically qualified as a production-based engine, a V8 engine, yeah, to compete in that category. But we did talk to Toyota because we wanted them as our first choice. And they went to the Lexus division and talked to them about helping on the engine thing, and Toyota was going to do the engines. And Toyota had had a division that had done, in Southern California, they opened some boat dealerships, and they tried to sell these boats with Lexus engines in them. Lee White looked at the whole thing and thought, well, you know what? We could probably do that engine if Grand Am will allow us to do it. So he talked to Jim France, and they got the thing passed, and they made some cam covers that said Lexus on them. And
nice of them.
We had a production-based V8 engine that was actually, Walker Evans, Ivan Stewart had won the Baja 1000 with one of these engines. So it worked out really well. We started out, and we had great support from Telmex with Carlos Slim,
yep,
who wanted to have drivers in their driver development program race in North America.
Yeah.
So in the first year, we actually ran two cars, one car with Jimmy Morales, who was the headmaster of the scholarship program from Mexico, and Luis Diaz was the other driver. And then in the other car, we had Scott Pruitt and Max Pappas. And we went to the first race, which was to the Daytona 24-hour race. We didn't have a chance.
you had the most combustible driver lineup in the history of the world.
Yeah, well, to start with, in the race, I think it rained for 18 straight hours. Goodyear ran out of rain tires, and they had to red flag the race while another truck came from northern Florida with more rain tires of the previous version. I mean, that in itself for us was tough because we didn't know how to keep a cockpit dry yet. We were learning about that, nor to keep the we had all the humidity level inside the car so the drivers couldn't see out of the car. We were learning about pit stops. We were miserable in that first race. But you know what? We worked really, really hard, and we ended up winning the championship that year.
Yeah.
Out of the gate. But we certainly weren't ready to win a long-distance race, nor I thought we were – I would hate to admit this, but I will. I don't think we were ready the next year to win a 24-hour race.
Hmm.
But by the third year, after two full seasons, beginning the third season, we were ready. And we were certainly open-wheel people who were learning how to race sports cars.
Yeah.
Both in endurance and sprint racing. You know, we questioned ourselves at the beginning thinking, man, should we hire ringers to help us? What should we do? And we said, well, you know what? Screw this. For the long term, let's figure out how to do it the way we would like to do it and see if it works. And we transferred open wheel people onto the program, hired really good race drivers, all four of them at the beginning, and carried on. And I guess, as they say, the rest is history. We've won a lot of races overall in that series. We've won the big races in that series, and that's led us to where we are now.
You authored one of the great quotes, in many, many, many years. I think it was, again, mid-late 2000s. Someone asked you, as a noted IndyCar team manager, race strategist, how do you go about an endurance race, a 24-hour race? Mm-hmm. How do you go about that from a strategy standpoint? Because you're used to 2 hours with IndyCar.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about that at the 24 hours of Daytona? And you had a great quote of saying, we treat this as 24 one-hour races.
Yes.
I always found that fascinating because... damn it, Mike, it sounds so simple. And beforehand, I'm like, why didn't I think of that? But I hadn't really seen things put in that kind of context. But I thought, how brilliant. Instead of trying to treat endurance racing as this big crazy animal that's totally foreign and different, no, simplify. Okay, yeah, it's really long, but maybe if we look at this in much smaller bites, we can manage that. We can win that. That just means, but granted, we then have to win 24 races to get to a victory lane.
I think that's right. I think you can win every day in your life. We happen to be under a magnifying glass in this case, but I think you can win every day if you work with one sentence at a time.
Mm.
If you try to compose an entire paragraph, you'll never grammatically get out the door. And I think that's what purposeful race teams really do. They break it down, as you said, and they understand completely that you have to win today. And in this case, with a 24-hour race, your day is 24 hours. So you have to win 1 hour or one segment at a time. You have to do your best to be the best when that driver when you change drivers, or when you come in for fuel and tires, or if you come under a full course yellow. And all the people that work on your team, whether they go over the wall, whether they're behind the wall, whether they're feeding the guys during 24 hours, whether they're doing public relations, whether they're keeping the sponsors excited about 24 hours of racing, whatever it might be, I think everybody has to win in their job together. And the only way the best way to do that is to continue to work on the present, not work on the future. And I think that could be said for any race, whether it be a NASCAR race, whether it be a sports car race, whether it be an IndyCar race, whether it be a drag race. You know, we're sitting here looking out at the start line for NHR drag racing, and I've gone to a few of these races. like the U.S. Nationals was just after our Watkins Glen race. You go up on that starting line and you watch the really good race drivers, the ones that consistently win races and championships. How do they focus for that minimum amount of time where they block everything out? It's not a surprise that they know how to do that, and I don't think it's any different than any other kind of sport. That's exactly what you do.
So, piggybacking on that, and this isn't just, I'm not trying to just throw little happy bon mots your way, but one of the things I've always appreciated about our conversations, and we've had many, 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 is speaking to you about the past, history, how things work. That's always awesome. When we tend to speak about the present, something that happened in the race today, your approach has always been exactly as you just mentioned, the present. And there's that sense of looking forwardness, not a word, but there's that sense of looking forwardness that I appreciate and have to believe that's part of a culture of success at your team and others. I remember, I think it was Cleveland 1996, our driver Mark Hotchkiss was either on pole or second, and Alex Padilla, bit of a hammerhead, went sailing down the thing you're most afraid of at Cleveland.
Yeah.
Everyone went to the left to try and get at the start to get a good line through turn one. He said, aha, wide open real estate, went sailing down the inside, the dirty inside, wiped out our driver Hotchkiss and a few others, screwed our race. It should have been a great day. And I just remember being so angry, like, let's go kill him. And I remember Hotchkiss with the same kind of approach that you have, saying, it's over. It's done. Yeah, it sucks, but it's done. The only thing we have right now, other than fixing the car, is going to the next one and getting that one right. Is this something that has just always been a sensibility for you of, yeah, whatever, but we still have a place to go next? Or is that just...
No, I think all of us are very competitive people in this business. If we weren't or we aren't, we should probably find something else to do. Mm. And I think that really gets you worked up internally inside. But you have to have presence of mind and you have to be able to exhale. I would say in your case with Hotchkiss as a driver, I've always felt that was a driver thing. That was between drivers.
Mm.
You know, drivers should be able to look each other in the eye because they actually know what happened. They were driving it, okay? They know what they did. If they don't want to admit to the other driver that they caused the problem, then, in my opinion, that's a total lack of integrity on their part.
Yeah.
You have to still drive around them on the racetrack, but we don't drive around them in the pit lane as the supporting cast. So I think to answer your question, yes. I mean, you get really disturbed, upset about it. You want to strike out at somebody.
I haven't seen you throw clipboards, I should say. Maybe that's the best way of putting it.
Yeah.
We've seen other team owners or managers do that, and they're pounding stuff.
Yeah, I haven't tossed a headset for a while, but the thing is...
maybe just for fun.
Yeah, maybe I should get one. I should get our guys to rubberize one up and give it a toss.
Nice.
I get really upset and amped up, and being with Scott Dixon for as long as I've been with him, I think we can talk each other up and talk each other down pretty quickly.
Mm.
Both of us get really upset. The problem is if we get upset at the same time, we're in deep trouble. we try to I think probably pour water on each other sometimes when we're in the heat of the moment. But it's tough sometimes to define reality.
You just brought up the next topic of conversation. I've said many times and for many years, my opinion at least, Dixie is the best of his generation. That's no disrespect to Dario. That's just looking at someone who has been in essentially one championship for this long and earned that many titles over the entire span. Phenomenal. What was that guy like when he showed up for the first time? What did you think, this relatively skinny ginger with a wacky accent showing up, good Lord, what, 14 years ago now?
Yeah, we started with him in 2002.
Yeah.
Mid-year 2002 when the Bruce McCaw thing fell apart.
Yeah,
and Scott was available, and he was a Toyota driver, and Toyota really wanted him to continue on. And frankly, the reason was very simple. People probably didn't realize at the time what was going on. We had already made a deal going forward for 2003 to be in the IRL series. We were racing the kart series in 2002, but we knew that at that time the IRL series was an all-oval series, and we were running Jeff Ward in that series in 2002. Yep. With
there's some drivers on the Ganassi list that folks might not recall.
And yeah. And he won. And he won for us. Awesome. He won for us at Texas, and that's actually a terrific story. We were at the kart race at Laguna Seca when the Texas race was going on Saturday night, and for the first time, as our I think it was the first time publicly. We had a sponsor event at Carmel Valley Ranch on Saturday night, and there was a large screen television in there. So I attended the event. Chip was there. Several other of us were there, and all these people from Microsoft were there. And it was our first time hosting them, and they were a big partner of Target's, so there was a natural connection. And so Chip asked if they could turn the television on, because we were racing in a different location. So we had to explain to the Microsoft people how that worked. And they got onto it right away, and they got really got invested in the race. And it got down to the end, and Jeff got the lead right at the end and won the race. And the Microsoft people said, man, this is easy. This looks like a... And they said, you know what? This looks like a lot of fun. And that... If there was ever a doubt about them coming on board, it was taken care of right there with that big screen television. It was really, really neat. Jeff Ward was such a fantastic, competitive person and truly a legend. I remember going to Orange County, the Orange County Fairgrounds when I still lived in California, watching him do demonstration. They had older guys that would show up. I can't remember what the motorcycle was. He was like 12, 13 years old.
Kawasaki.
It was something like, no, but it was, I think it might have been pre-Kawasaki, but they had like these grudge, before the Speedway bike events, they had this thing going on with Jeff, and the promoter there would put money up for anybody that could come out and beat him on the same bike.
Wow.
And he kicked everybody's ass every time. It was great to watch. He was such a Southern California legend. He was terrific and a terrific person. And to this day, I mean, he's a teammate. You know, when you see him, he's a teammate. He's still one of our teammates, a terrific, terrific person. And I don't honestly remember what the original question was.
Oh, we're talking about... sorry, Dixie, we still love you. What did you think of this skinny Kiwi kid who showed up who, I don't want to say you inherited, but, you know, there was weird circumstances. You look at what you two have achieved today and would think, well, we scouted him from the minute, and this was, you know, he was our Lewis Hamilton. We groomed him all the way, and look at what we've reaped. I don't want to say you guys lucked out, but fortune smiled on you getting a hold of him.
It worked really well. I mean, well, Toyota had a high opinion about him. We certainly didn't know anything about him other than watching him race. He had won at Nazareth in the kart series, so he'd won on an oval. They wanted us to evaluate him, and they helped us put him in a car from Milwaukee onward that season. And simply to see if that was if we wanted to have him as a keeper, starting when we ran the IRL series, and we did, as it turned out. And such a naturally gifted, underrated, unassuming person. I don't know that that's really ever changed, to be honest about it. Maybe the underrated part has changed now to hashtag rated, but he's certainly all of the above.
How has he evolved since you guys first met as a driver? Because what we see today, the guy who makes a trillion miles per gallon, the guy who destroys lap records, four-time series champion, you know, all the accolades that we know. Did you see the potential in all that when he first showed up? Did you have a feeling he could be that guy? Or how did he get to where he is?
I think like the rest of us do at Chip Ganassi Racing, we work on our craft every day, and that's what he's done. I think he's been blessed because at Chip Ganassi Racing, he has had an all-star roster of teammates.
Mm.
And
that's another underrated portion of his character. Chameleon's the wrong way to put it. He is someone who is able to absorb and add to his own skill set like no other driver I've seen.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we started in the IRL series, we hired Thomas Schechter to be his teammate.
Because you guys like
Thomas Schechter was so fast on medium-sized ovals. Okay, 1.5 mile ovals, which the series had a lot of 1.5 miles that you doubled up on, you went back. And Thomas was just ungodly fast. And Scott was really good on the short tracks. I think we won 4 short track races that year, I think so, and we won a championship. But what Thomas did for Scott, I thought, was he showed Scott how fast you could truly go on a 1.5 mile oval. So there was no doubt when you looked at the data what the target area was, to use that term. And I think that really helped Scott to win the championship, because he didn't win on the big ovals in the first year, but he ran close to the front and raced wheel to wheel. In those days, that's what you did, by having a lot of confidence in the fact that the car could do it. And I think each of his teammates have provided him an avenue for improvement. And he has never been afraid to not only study what they do, but ask them how they do it. And he, in turn, has been totally unselfish with what his strengths are. So over the years, I think each one of those teammates have contributed to his success, and he's contributed to theirs. Very much a two-way street. That's been, I think, evidenced all the way to today. His teammates today, his teammates a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. You know, when Dan came on board with us,
Dan Weldon
was on the top pedestal of being the consummate oval track driver, because he was absolutely frictionless. He could drive in qualifying to the white line. He could do it for an entire run. He could do things on an oval with a car that people would just stand back and say, wow, how does he do that?
Yeah.
And Scott was lucky enough to see how that worked. And I think Scott's drive style today on an oval is directly related to that.
And he credits his time with Dan for unlocking a lot on the oval side.
They didn't get along at the beginning, and I don't really know why. Because, you know, Dan just had it all out there. He just had it all out in front, and he was so confident in his ability that
classic introvert and extrovert, you know. Yeah. Hey, let's put the cat and dog in the bag together. Oh, they don't get along.
Yeah, but it you know what, it did work out. They did finally get along, and they really did help each other, not only while Dan drove for us, but certainly after that friendship continued on. And I think all of that happened. You know, you asked about Scott's fuel mileage situation. The way that product developed, the way he really truly developed with that, the drive style he has today, came from the help that we received from Toyota.
Mm.
Because when we were a Toyota team,
in the IRL,
and the engines in 2005, frankly, were terrible.
Yeah.
And
they weren't long for the series either.
Well, we didn't know that. They sort of forgot to tell us that they were moving to NASCAR. And but they still supported us fully.
Sure.
They just didn't work on the things that created a power level to be as competitive as we needed to be.
Minor detail.
Yeah, it's okay. But what they did do was you had unlimited testing, and they funded testing. Of all kinds of testing, whatever it was. One of the things that we did was we spent days at the racetrack learning how to go longer for a lap.
Because you couldn't go faster.
And guess who did that testing? All that testing. Scott Dixon. And so somebody asked me the other day, how does he do it? And I said, well, you know, the hip bone's connected to the knee bone's connected to the ankle bone. It's the ankle bone. It's understanding how to create lap time without using the brakes, if you think about it.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do, and be brave enough to do it.
I've said he'd be the world's best spec Miata driver. You know, you've got 115 horse. You can't use the brakes. It's all about momentum. In this scenario, though, it's using that momentum to make fuel mileage. I mean, we're coming off Watkins Glen where Dixie destroyed everybody on outright speed. And then when he had to get exceptional mileage to close the race, he even heard the commentator saying, but he pitted like two or three laps before Elio, and Elio just had to do a splash and go, and, you know, can he make it? And, just like, whatever, no worries.
Well, you know, we never know. What we do is we do tell Scott from the very beginning of a run, in this case an entire run, we tell him what he needs to make if there's no more yellow. So he can tell us by us watching the data, obviously, if he can do it. If he can't do it, then we're going to do what Helio did at Watkins Glen. We're going to change the strategy, yes, because then what we're going to do is we're going to go to full rich and try to make up as much track position, get out as far as we can, because then it's going to be a time stop, yeah, and you have to race to that time stop. And we've done it both ways with him. The Watkins Glen race was kind of interesting, I thought, because he had a terrific car there. He just seemed to be in a different stratosphere on Sunday there, as well as the weekend. But the first 70% of the race, or 65% of the race, was speed. It was Scott Dixon not making fuel.
Yeah.
It was Scott Dixon going as fast as he could to make up the most open track position for the green stops. So we chose to come in a little early on the first one, first of all, because we were gun-shy about full course yellow. But we worked on making up. It also helped us because we didn't come in on the scrum on the what would have been the first green stop. Those guys came in when the pit lane was closed, but then on the second green stop, we worked and did the same thing. Then the last third of the race became a fuel mileage race. And so Scott Dixon, I thought, didn't get credit, in my opinion, by a lot of people for being enormously fast and then being very cranial for the last part of the race. And he did something that only two other people did. The first one of those people that finished second was 19 seconds behind him at the end. I think that he deserves credit for doing exactly what you're talking about, understanding what you have to do to win. So it's not a surprise that he's won all these races.
So you two have been working together for damn near a decade and a half. You've seen the guy just do outrageous, silly things. I asked this of Chris Simmons, engineer, who's been working with him directly now for a couple years, but not super long. Do you ever get a little, I don't know, blasé is the word, but, you know, if you've seen Jesus perform 305 miracles, the 306, you're probably not going to be falling over and jumping up and down. Has there come a point with Dixie where when he does these remarkable things, you just kind of go, yeah, that's normal? Or are you still able to appreciate, wow, he's an extraordinary human being, extraordinary athlete. This is still just, you know, as fresh of a surprise, or close to fresh, as it once was.
I don't know. If you're from the San Francisco area, would you have said that about Joe Montana? You know, he won four Super Bowls, right? Did he win three or four, whatever he won?
Four.
Or if you lived in Pittsburgh, would you have said that about the Steelers? I mean, the thing is I think what we do is no different than what the fans do. They come to see it again. They come to see talent. They hang on the fence like we do. They want to see extraordinary things from extraordinary athletes. And Scott Dixon is an extraordinary athlete in this sport. I think if he weren't driving an IndyCar, I think I'd call him a throwback guy. I don't know how to use the word exactly, but he's a person that with a proper amount of time in any other car, in any other series, would be winning races, because he would study his teammates. He would study the competition. He would understand the formula. He would work with the guys that work on his car. He would work with his engineer or his crew chief, depending on the series. And, you know, he'd be able to cut a light at a drag strip. He'd be able to race effectively a stock car. If he were driving a sports car series, the Global Series WEC, I think he'd be driving for a factory team. And in the sports car races where we've participated with him, he certainly carried his fair share. So I think that as long as he wants to participate, he's going to participate at this level.
Yeah. You work for Chip Ganassi. For those of us who know Chip, we marvel at your ability to do that, to not been hauled off to an insane asylum, to not killed the guy. I mean, this is a little bit tongue-in-cheek. We all love Chip. He is 100% his own man. You guys have been working together. You have been his go-to guy, run his racing teams for decades now. How is that relationship work, knowing that demeanor-wise, not saying work style-wise, but at least demeanor-wise, Chip is big, bold, demanding. You, for everything that I've seen and how you work, go about things in a slightly different way. Is that a complementary relationship? Is this good cop, bad cop? How has this relationship worked so well for so long?
I think we both want the same things to begin with. We have that in common. We both want to get the most out of today. Yesterday and tomorrow don't matter to us, either one of us. We have that in common. Chip's presence creates accountability. And on top of that, what I really do like about Chip and have since before I went to work for him, for that matter, but since working for him, and I appreciate it more and more and more, is the fact that he gets right to the point. It's one sentence. And some people are offended by that sentence. And some people aren't. But I think the reality is he defines direction quickly, and it's up to people like us who work at Chip Ganassi Racing, whether it be somebody like me or whether it be somebody else. It doesn't matter who it is. And in whatever division it is, he expects excellence to happen. And when it doesn't happen, what he expects is that all of the people will participate as a group to make it better. It's actually a very simple thing. Not that hard to create a culture to achieve that if you get everybody inside the corral making it happen. We've had good days and bad days. We've had good years and bad years. But guess what? We finished second and third a lot. And some people think that's, in our case, a failure. But the reality is, it's every one of those has been a learning experience for us. It's made us stronger. It's made us tighter as a group. Mm. And Chip is absolutely supportive of every team member that we have. And I think that's really hard to find. I also think that you should work for owners in racing if you have a choice who have raced cars.
Yeah.
And he raced cars. He raced motorcycles before he raced cars as a kid. Then he got into cars. And I think owners who have been drivers have a leg up on the rest of the pack. So he understands what it feels like to win, and he understands what it feels like to lose. And he understands when compassion is important, and he understands when a swift kick is also important. That is hard to find.
What are the days like, or even sometimes maybe seasons? Not every season has been a winning one for Chip Ganassi Racing, sports cars, IndyCar, NASCAR. I think most people in our sport know the team name, the track record, aware that there's been a lot of consuming of milk at Indianapolis, a lot of championship celebrations. There have been forks in the road where there's probably needed to be more kicks or voices raised. What has it been like, or maybe you can give me an example of a time where we're not on that championship track, we're not where we should be, How do you do that, and how do you turn that internally while still getting buy-in from the people you work with? Because it's real easy to go to the shop floor and say, you mother effer, right? It's easy to MF people, thinking that that's going to fix the problem. That's going to have a lot of people pushing their toolboxes out the door. How do you turn things around when they need to be turned?
I think the way you create energy is to reassign people, not push them out the door. Oftentimes, it's the mix of people, because this business is a people business. This business is not firing people. This business is about engaging people. And we've been very lucky at Chip Ganassi Racing because we've had multiple entries and different series where we race. So we've been able to move people within the program by looking at their strengths and weaknesses that they might not realize as time goes on, and realize that they're an asset to us, and give them opportunity. Normally the opportunity shouldn't be the door. The opportunity should be a chance to improve. And oftentimes when you do that, you energize the entire group, because all of a sudden the mix of people, when it changes internally for us, they start listening to a different mindset. This is how I would have done it. What do you think about that? And working on an individual entry, sometimes you don't hear that. So that's what we try to do. We've also had people that have moved from our Indianapolis location to our North Carolina location, or the other way around. So we have some of that, not a great deal of it, but we have some of it. Not many racing organizations globally allow that to happen. It's terrific when we can take, and we've done, this year's a good example of it. We moved a rear-end mechanic from Scott Dixon's car, who had been there for a long time, to be a crew chief on this 67 Ford GT car, because he deserved a promotion. We didn't have a promotable position for him on the IndyCar team. Wow. So that helps him. It helps us. He was ready for the job, so that's what we did. There's a lot of examples of that on our shop floor, at the racetrack, on the race teams, where we've moved people into different positions to make things better, and their perspective always makes, it's interesting, they watch somebody else do that job for a long time.
Yeah.
Invariably, every person that gets an intercompany promotion makes that job better. Hmm. Because they do it because they've watched it happen in front of them. They've seen somebody in the job they're going to take on, and they're taking notes, and they're saying, you know what, I would have done it this way, or I'll do it that way, or this is what I'd have the people that work on my program do, or whatever. I think that actually happens, and we've moved people from, as an example, this last year we took Nick Ford, who was a rear-end mechanic for us, and he's now in our building. He doesn't travel, and he's in charge of fabric, he's in charge of the paint shop, the carbon shop, the body fit, all the things it takes to make the cars, the fit and finish on the cars, correct. And he, as a racing person, understands what that truly means in a competitive environment. And he's taken that role on, and he's made that role better by bringing in the way that he would do things and how competitive he is. And he gets his people there engaged in doing that. It's the same group of people, but I think they're energized because Nick's been in there. And so that's how we operate. It's been very good. Scott Harner, who's worked for us now for years, I hired him 20, I don't know, he'd be able to tell me, at least 22 years ago. And when he came to us, he drove a truck and worked in the fab shop. Mm. And now he's a senior manager for us. He looks after a lot of team manager responsibilities logistically, as well as on the human resource side. He's engaged very seriously in the direction of our team. He does a terrific, terrific job. Barry Wanzer, who works for us, worked for Joe Amato for years, and came to work for us. He came to work for us and worked in the transmission shop at the very, very beginning, and he's worked his way through the system. We promoted him to be the crew chief on Jeff Ward's car in the IRL series, and from there, moved on up through the chain. So that's how we do it. It seems to work really well for us. I don't know if it would work for anybody else or not, because racing isn't about individuals. Racing is about a group of individuals who work as a team. And you can't take, somebody said, oh, they just hired that guy over there, and man, he's fantastic. And he goes somewhere else, and he's a miserable failure.
You've just described my career, by the way. But
okay. So I think it's about everybody pulling their weight, pulling together, and making it better, and being committed for the long term. And you asked me that question about Chip a few minutes ago. I think that's what's so great about Chip, is he's committed to build for the long term, for the future. And probably the difference between Chip and myself is the fact that Chip looks down the road. Not that I don't, but he really looks down the road. He focuses in on where we should be going. What's the resource going to be? What should the direction be? We talk about that, but he really drives that ship. And my job is to get that ship from the harbor past the breakwater and out there and get it running, getting it running right.
Yeah.
And he's working on the horizon a little further down the road for us, and that works really well.
I'm just bouncing around here as usual, and I've also fully realized we've got podcast 3, 4, 5, and 27 on our horizon. Thanks to our friends at what we now call Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca, was reminded today that we are ready to celebrate the 20-year anniversary of The Pass. Mm. Something, a great part, one of maybe the most memorable parts of the team's early-ish IndyCar days in 96, with a young Italian friend, Mr. Zanardi, passing, I don't know if we should put it this way, but essentially passing the guy who was in that car the year before, Brian Herta. What did that mean back then? I mean, we still talk about it today. Motor racing is about passing, or it should be about passing. Your team, your driver authored something that has been deemed the actual name of what we try and do, The Pass. How big was that for you guys back then? Maybe in the context of the fact that 20 years later, we're still talking about it.
Well, on that day, it was fantastic. I would just say, preface that by saying that at some point in time after that, somebody came along, and I don't know which race director it was or whatever the person's title, chief steward, whatever it was at the time, and painted lines on the road and painted markers on the road and said, you have to be in this place in this corner, or you can't pass after this spot, or you can't even act like you're blocking. And you certainly can't go off the road and come back on, because if you did that, wow, that would be a penalty. So today, we race in a totally different environment. I'm not sure which one is better, but people like us, Marshall, we grew up when passing was what you tried to do to win the race. But in fairness to that statement, we were not racing spec cars then.
Yeah.
So that also has contributed to the differences in racing. But that pass that he made, he would have been told on the radio that he has to give up the position before he gets to start finish line, or he's going to get a penalty. Think about that.
Yeah.
Is that right? I don't think so. So, you know, when that car was being run on the racetrack at every place where we raced in 1996, and that was Alex's first year, and by then, he had a full head of steam.
Oh, yeah.
He did. And
when I go to the track this weekend, by the way, I'm going to get some paint and try and put it in the dirt so people know that.
Well, you know what happened? You know what did happen after that race was, you know, Skip Barber at the time was based at the racetrack, and I was told what happened was they had a school race, and somebody decided to do the pass. But the problem was they had put a tire wall up there. And so the pass didn't actually work.
It became the hit.
It became, look out, the tires are flying. What Alex did, and I was on that car in 96 with Morris Nunn, and what Alex would do is he would just dartboard Morris continually by saying, Morris, please tell me when my last run is on the tires. Please tell me when my last run is on the tires. Tell me when we're going to switch to slicks. And he would come in and say, slicks yet? We said, no, not yet. But the tires are worn out. You can do another run. So finally, we'd say, okay, this is the last run. So big smile on his face, because what he would do at every road track where we raced, is he would purposely go out there and drive down the insides of all the places where potentially you could pass or somebody might think you could pass. Yeah. In his case, he thought he could. And he would get on the brakes so hard to understand what would happen. And his braking technique was maybe a little different at the time because he would really brake hard. Then he would lift off the brake, coast into the corner, and then get on the brakes again. That's what he did. That's how he passed people. And so at Laguna, as an example, every set of tires, all the way up until the race, when it was the last run on the tires, he went down the three braking areas, the hard braking areas, and made the tires square and came in. So it was the last lap, it was the last lap of the race at Laguna. He tried in the first one. That didn't work down the inside. Tried in the second one, into five, I think it was, up the inside there. And I can't imagine how he held onto the steering wheel going to the corkscrew because the tires had to be absolutely square. But he went down the inside, and he miscalculated, I think, a little bit on the release of the brakes.
Yeah.
Or he had a little too much speed. And Brian was really a good driver because he could sense things happening around him. And he gave Alex room. I'm sure thinking that Alex was never going to come into sight again, but he did.
Farewell.
And it broke the radiator, I remember, and Alex certainly wouldn't have done another complete hot lap.
Yeah.
It would have been a hot lap. It would split the radiator in half, but he won the race, and Jimmy Vassar won the championship.
Yep.
That was the first year we won a championship together. I think you could hear the exhale from every team member at Chip Ganassi Racing when Alex came by and Jimmy won the championship.
Wow.
So that was a big moment for us in two regards. And Alex was such an engaging person, and he defined what you needed to do to be a teammate.
Hmm.
That really helped everybody that worked on the team. A lot of those people that worked on his car and Jimmy's car are still with us.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And they're in different positions today, most of them, but they're still with us, and they still carry that fire breather attitude with them on a daily basis in the building, if that's where they work, or at the shop where they still work, either one.
Immense loyalty within the team, maybe on that topic, and we're winding down here towards the finish of this hour. Target. Remember when they came in? I remember it took me quite a while to figure out that livery on Eddie Cheever's car, to figure out what the hell it was, and then I saw a shot from overhead. It was like, oh, you moron, that's the Target. I had a little mini middle-age crisis of going, good Lord, you know, 26, 27 years of my life, from when Target came in as a sponsor to where, you know, here, unfortunately, in a matter of days, we're going to be farewelling Target on the IndyCar program. What has that been like? Is having such an enduring partner, then maybe I'll tie that into a couple of other themes. This 14-plus year relationship you've had working directly with Scott Dixon, Target being on that car, and also the fact that whether it's a Wayne, whether it's this mechanic or that mechanic, there's so many people that have been truly loyal and long-term members of the Chip Ganassi Racing family. Seems like decades are just part of what of how you guys do business. Long themes of so many things in that team. What's it like knowing that the Bolt, that Target logo, we're not going to see that on the IndyCar at the end of the season? It must be a little bit weird.
I think it will be for lots of people besides the people that work at Chip Ganassi Racing. Target will still be with us because what they've done for us is we've grown up with them. They've helped us in so many ways away from the racetrack to understand ourselves, to understand Target. If you went to a Target store or you went to the corporate office in Minneapolis, or you went to a distribution center for Target, wherever you go, what you see in there is what you see at the racetrack. You see a team of people that work together. That's really what they're all about. And the CEOs of Target have created that seamless transition They haven't tried to change the culture internally. They've simply worked within that culture, that teamwork environment. That's what we do. I think that's why we're so good, or we have been so good together. You know, there was a time where a lot of us went to Minneapolis and did management training. Target took us on. That really made a difference for us because it made us realize how important it was to feed off each other, to help each other, totally. It's not that we weren't doing that. It's just that they really helped us understand subject matter in a different way when it came to running a business of people, because that's what we are. We're in the people business. That's the business they're in. Secondly, Target, because of what is the vendor program, the sponsors that we have on the car, they're about partnership. Mm. They define partnership better than most people do that are in the business world. By being involved in that, then everything we've done is truly a direct extension of that on a larger scale.
Yeah.
So all our partners unselfishly give to each other. Maybe, Chip certainly works really, really hard to make sure that everybody in the system, whether they people work for us, whether they be people who are on the outside, the commercial sponsors, whoever they are, they're treated equally as partners. And I think that that is something we've truly, truly gotten from Target. I really think to define Chip Ganassi's strength, when you asked about that a little while ago, and it just made me think because we're talking about Target.
Yeah.
When Manassian and Bruno drove for us at Indianapolis, it was the year after Vassar and Montoya had driven there, I think. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's correct. That's correct. So we started out the time there because we were a CART team, but we started out running Manassian and Bruno, and they were trying to get around the place, trying to figure it out.
Brand new.
And Chip was a little frustrated with it because he wants to go fast at Indy. Let's face it, we all do. So he said, you know, we got enough cars here. We had enough G-forces. And he said, let's go get a couple more drivers. Let's just run a couple more drivers. So who are we going to get? Oh, well, we got Vassar. Okay, but we got to get another guy. Who are we going to get? So I don't know who it was. One of us said, well, what about Tony Stewart? Oh. Chip says, well, I sort of know Tony. Okay. Call him up. So he calls him up. Tony says, yeah, I'd like to do it. But the only problem was Tony was sponsored by Home Depot.
Mm.
Now think about that for a minute.
Yes, he was.
Okay.
Big NASCAR sponsor.
And we had a Target car. So Chip said, well, that's really easy. Now here's the one-sentence approach. I'm going to get both CEOs on the phone at the same time and say to them, we've got a great opportunity here. You guys want to pair up on this car?
Wow.
And that happened. So we had a red and orange car, and we had a great time. I mean, it worked well. It was a terrific partnership for one race. They obviously aren't going to do business together every day, but they did business together there. And I think that's that was a defining moment for a lot of people to understand how you can define result through capability.
Yeah.
It was a terrific moment for us.
And that was my man, Mike Hull. Really looking forward to getting some more time where we can capture a third episode. Probably try and focus that almost exclusively on sports cars, but we also have a lot of other fun stuff to delve into. Our shared passion for Formula Fords, especially the 70s and 80s Formula Ford scene in California. Is also the driving instructor for racer founder Paul Fanner. That'll be interesting to get into. And on the racer topic, this is the first Marshall Pruitt podcast that is making its exclusive breaking debut on racer.com. So hopefully you've enjoyed this. We will be doing some more that hit racer first before anywhere else. And as I am absolutely confident, there's going to be a lot more fun here to do in the digital audio realm with Racer. So if you're a fan of IndyCar racing, fan of sports car racing, you can look forward to fresh content every morning from myself, Robin Miller, Mark Glendening, a lot of other great people who put together Racer.com. And while you're there, go ahead and sign up for the Racer Daily Bulletin, which will make sure that you get the anthology of content that flows through the website each and every day. So, as always, thanks for listening.